I agree. It is an anthropocentric take. And that, I think, is very important because, as Ashley says, we are not separate or unlinked from the environment. And stewarding the environment, whether we're doing it for personal gain or because we care, is what we as humans are doing. And that brings us to the center in ways that I think are very important in terms of moving forward and changing our behavior and changing this trajectory.
And do you see policymakers responding?
I think so. One of the things that's so exciting about this is that it is a report of the governments. There are 132 member states who are part of this platform, and they approved this document. This is something that governments say we think is important.
We want to thank you both for being with us. Of course, we're going to link to the report. Kate Brauman is one of the coordinating lead authors of the new UN report on extinction. Environmental scientist at the University of Minnesota speaking to us from Minneapolis. And Ashley Dawson is a professor at the CUNY Graduate Center. His books include Extinction, A Radical History, as well as Extreme Cities, The Peril and Promise of Urban Life in the Age of Climate Change. Well, that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for paid six-month internships here in our New York City studio. Learn more at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Massoud, Tarina Nadura, Tamari Astudio, and Libby Rainey. Mike DeFilippo and Miguel Noguera are our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, David Prude, Ishmael Darrow, Vesta Gadars, and Karl Marxer. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us.
You're tuned in to KBOO Portland. The time is 8:01. Coming up next is Voice from the Edge with guest host Rochelle Dixon. But first, this from KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of The More Who Die, The Less We Care, Confronting Genocide and the Deadly Arithmetic of Compassion, on Thursday, May 9th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Oregon Jewish Museum and Center for Holocaust Education in Portland. The More Who Die, The Less We Care. Why does this occur? Professor Paul Slovic will discuss why people and governments ignore mass murder and genocide. His most recent work examines psychic numbing and the failure to respond to mass human tragedies. Again, that's The More Who Die, The Less We Care, on Thursday, May 9th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Oregon Jewish Museum and Center for Holocaust Education, 724 Northwest Davis Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Tomorrow Will Be, Friday, May 10th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall in Portland. Tomorrow Will Be is an all-ages event presented as the final show of Boom Art's multi-generational Festive Revolution season. This song-sharing and community celebration is inspired by the project Primer for a Failed Superpower. Following the performance, the audience is invited to meet with local activists and organizations at the Social Justice Fair. Again, that's Tomorrow Will Be, Friday, May 10th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall, 1422 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're tuned into KBOO Community Radio. Coming up next is Voices from the Edge, where guest host Rochelle Dixon talks to Onesha Cochran, former program manager with the Diane Wade House. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Cotton Cloud Natural Beds and Furniture, women owned since 1981, providing sustainable wood furniture, locally handcrafted futons, latex mattresses, and more, using organic and natural materials. The Cotton Cloud showroom is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. Online at cottoncloudfutons.com. And now, Voices from the Edge.
Hello, this is Rochelle Dixon. Good morning, good morning. I am sitting in the KBOO studio along with my guest, Sonisha Cochran Dumas, and she is the former program manager with the Diane Wade House. You might have read a little bit about her in the Oregonian. Lots of things going on there. I'm not going to steal her thunder at all. I'm going to let her tell her own story in her very own words. But first of all, I just want to welcome her to the show. Thank you, Sonisha, for coming here today. I appreciate it. How are you this morning?
I'm doing okay. Thank you for inviting me to the show.
Okay. Well, I'm glad that you're here. So for folks that don't know your background, can you share a little bit of your history with us and tell us a little bit about yourself?
So I came to Portland, Oregon to meet my mother in 2001. I was in my addiction at the time, and I went to prison right away for a fist fight with my sister. We both were high and drunk at the time of the incident, and I did 18 months in prison. Before that, I had did 4 years in prison in Missouri at the age of 18. And so my entry and my experience with Oregon right away was in the prison system. I had been in Portland for 6 days. When I got out for doing the 18 months, I was out for 33 days. And then I committed another crime that was drug related and went to prison for 105 months after serving 6 months in the county. So that was 111 months total. After I got out that time, I got clean with the help of my parole officer and the support from the Black community. They embraced me. They showed me how to get recovery, and that's how I got clean. And that's when I started to become a productive member of society in Portland, Oregon. Got a job, got married to a woman, went back to school. The reason why I became passionate and my direction took me to working in this field is because I saw the way that I was treated when I tried to obtain treatment services, and I also saw the lack of addressing the issues that were bringing all the women to Coffee Creek to begin with.
Sure, I appreciate that. Let me ask you a quick question. When you were incarcerated, were you offered treatment at the time?
No, I didn't qualify for treatment. In order, when you're under a Measure 11 law, you don't normally qualify for any of the treatment services, the AIP services that will grant you good time and also give you the in-prison treatment services that some of the other women received, because they didn't fall under the Measure 11 law, or it wasn't written in the way that they were sentenced.
Oh, that sounds like a recipe for failure.
Yeah.
Because then they're re-releasing you after a drug offense with no treatment. And so it didn't take you but a short amount of time to go back into the same behaviors and then reoffend. Is that pretty clear?
That is correct. It's it's hard to think positive with nothing but negativity around you. And prisons, as we all know and have admitted publicly, officials and community members, prisons have become human warehouses. They haven't done a lot to mentally challenge the women to change the behavior, the criminal thinking, or to address the mental health disparities, or to address the addiction disease, the disease of addiction. It is a disease, and the women didn't ask for it, but it is something that a lot of us have. It's something that I myself have. And until it is addressed, then the cycle of going to get the drugs, drinking the alcohol, you're in the mindset to commit the crime, you commit the crime, you go back to prison, which is a cycle I got caught up in, and I went to prison 3 different times.
Yeah. So you said that there was a parole officer that helped you along your journey to start getting clean and sober. Tell me a little bit more about that experience.
So I want to be able to honor all of the people, and there were so many people on my journey that had a part of it. So even inside the prison, like Lieutenant Roberts was one of the people that at the time I felt like she was really hard on me. I felt targeted, but looking back, she saw something in me that I didn't see in myself, and so she tried to hold me accountable. And oftentimes when she did have to address my negative behavior, she would speak life into me and tell me that she saw me being more than what I was representing to the rest of the world. The same thing with Diane Wade when she came in with the African American program, and Nate Roberts and Javelin Hardy, when they brought in the African American program and they addressed the inmates. We were inmates at the time. They talked to us about what life could be like if we tried to change the behaviors that brought us into prison, and we gave ourselves a chance. chance to do something differently. And so at the time when you're hearing these things, there's the first time ever that somebody is telling you that life can be different, so you don't receive it right away, which is what happened with me. I didn't receive it on the spot the first time that they told me, because this is a practice that I had been living in for so long. It was habitual. So it took me some time to receive the blessings that they were speaking upon my life. And when I got out of prison, it took some time. By the time I got out, Diane Wade unfortunately passed away in 2010, and I was released in April of 2011, and she passed away at the end of the month in 2010. I think it was like October. And so although I worked with her inside the penitentiary, she unfortunately wasn't my parole officer when I got out. It was Javelin Hardy who worked with me, and consistent phone calls, consistent visits to the crack house. Like, Javelin Hardy would come and find me in the community, and maybe on the outside looking in, people couldn't connect that that cultural specific way that she approached me and the way that she talked to me was what I needed.
Sure. So these were women of color.
Women of color.
Were they black men. Women?
Black women.
Specifically black women.
Black women and black men. I don't want to leave the black man out. That sure. Black man don't have a part in the healing process of the black women. Black men and black women.
Mm-hmm. So Javelin Hardy basically tracked you down.
Yep.
And stopped and intervene in the behavior.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So, and not a soft touch either. Not a soft touch.
So in order to do that, it sounds like Javelin must have had a good relationship with the community to be able to enter the spaces and have access.
Absolutely. When you talk about black people and you talk about the way that we interact with each other, we don't have to read a book. We don't have to study a culture. We don't have to go to a training to learn how to be culturally agile. We were all raised in similar households. We were all raised with some habits that culturally, before any of us start doing drugs, you know, we knew what it was like to have cousins. We knew what it was like for us to be in one room and to be raised together and to have love for each other and to see those similarities. She did not have to feel unsafe in that culture. Mm-hmm. Even though she was a parole officer, a correctional officer, same with Lieutenant Roberts, same with Lieutenant Kaiser, they, even though they're in the correctional system, they brought something different to the table because they were black, because they knew some of the barriers that we faced, and then because they came at us with no fear. They were not afraid of us. They were not uncomfortable around us, and they loved us. They took that job and they wanted to help the community because they loved us, and it came across in everything that they did.
It definitely sounds like it. And I want to mention that you can call in. We are live. So you can call in. The number to call in is 503-231-8187. So that sounds like the parole officer got you started on your journey. And so after you became clean and sober, you said you got married. There were definitely some positive life events for you. I think you said you did some schooling and what did you study?
I went to school for addictions and alcohol and drug treatment, the program at PCC. I wanted to become a counselor. I had these dreams of like maybe one day running my own program. I want to make it real clear that I don't feel like the white people that work in treatment or recovery services, all of them are bad or out to get black people. That is not the message I want to get across. But the message that I do want to get across is sometimes as white people are dealing with their own trauma, guilt, and shame, and feelings of discomfort when we talk about racism, mm-hmm. implicit bias, mm-hmm. and serving the black client, that while they're trying to figure it out, we're dying. And so that's what I went through. I went through sometimes when I was going through black trauma, and you're talking about somebody who just smoked crack. So I have a couple of hours clean, basically. So my front lobe is flipped. And I'm going through all of these emotions, and I'm going through a mental health breakdown. I'm in the mist. I'm coming out of the mud with all of my stuff, and then I'm talking to someone who doesn't understand that, and they're taking my behavior as a trigger for them that makes them feel uncomfortable or afraid. If my counselor is feeling uncomfortable and afraid, and they're sitting across from me, and they don't know how to relate to me, then I'm lost. Then I'm another client out there that's not getting the services that they need provided to them. And I felt that was unfair. The reason why I went back to school to get my degree in this field is because I felt like we were doing a disservice, because we were creating these programs. We were creating treatment programs for people who had pro-social skills. And I felt like that was backwards. How can you create a treatment program that you're expecting people to come in and know how to say please and thank you, have good communication skills, have emotional regulation, and know how to address their criminal behaviors? You're talking about people that have been living in the streets their whole lives, been living in prisons their whole lives, but we're not creating treatment and recovery programs for them. We're creating people for people that should come in with pro-social skills. And I felt like that was backwards. We need to create programs for people to address the needs that are in the files. We've read the files. We know the trauma, so we need to create programs for those people, and that's the missing part that I felt was missing in the recovery programs that are offered here in Portland.
Okay, and most of the recovery programs that you've come across, not necessarily that you've been in, that you've experienced, seen, heard about, are there a lot of people of color? Are there a lot of Black individuals that are in these kinds of nonprofits? Generally, nonprofits are. Even with the state or the health department?
No, not as much as that I wish that I would see. So I think that in most organizations, especially the one that I just came from, Bridges to Change, most organizations reflect the population of what's in Oregon. So across Oregon, it's like 2.2% African American people. In Multnomah County, it's like 5% African American people. But in the criminal justice system, right, there's 27% African American people. So if you're offering a treatment, recovery, and especially reentry programs, then your reentry program should reflect 27% in their employee workforce that represents the population that you're serving. And that's what I don't see. And if you look at these organizations that are predominantly white, the employees are predominantly white, and then the clients end up being predominantly white. And they wonder why that is happening. And then they have these files and they say, well, we're not retaining Black employees and we're not serving the Black clients as well as we should. Well, your workforce doesn't reflect the numbers of the people who are suffering in the criminal justice system, which is 27% African American.
Sure. I think I hear that a lot, that nonprofits, and especially in Portland, don't reflect the populations that they serve. I want to mention that you are listening to Voices from the Edge. I'm Rochelle Dixon. I'm sitting in for Joanne Hardesty. And our guest today is Onisha Cochran Dumas. And she was a former program manager with the Diane Wade House. And so she's talking a little bit about her experience coming to Portland, her 111 months in the justice system, and then her transition to studying at Portland Community College, where she studied about addictions. And then from there, you went on to
PSU. Yeah, I went to PSU to study for my bachelor's degree. When this job came, I was an intern at Multnomah County for the Addictions and Mental Health. I did a 9-month internship there. I actually have 7 credits left to get my bachelor's
Congratulations.
Degree.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
That's exciting. So you're in this program, you're really, sounds like, excited about the work that you're able to do.
Absolutely.
And you feel comfortable doing it.
Yes.
The community is kind of behind you and supportive, it sounds like. And so you're ready to do this work. And how did you start with the Diane Wade House?
Well, the first time that it was introduced to me was, as I said, I was an intern at the Multnomah County Mental Health and Addiction Services team. And behind the scenes, policy was working on the Diane Wade House, and they had the MacArthur grant, which is a $2 million grant that wanted to serve and resolve the problem of recidivism rates for African-American females specifically.
So the Diane Wade House is culturally specific, specifically for African-American women. And that's what it is.
That's what it is.
Okay, and how many women are in the Diane Wade House, and when did it open?
It actually opened in a temporary house December the 15th, and the maximum capacity is 38 women. I don't know how many are in there right now.
Okay. Yeah. So you started this role when?
I started the role as an intern. I was asked by the policy team who were creating the program. This was before anybody was hired. This was even before they decided to name it the Diane Wade House. But they actually wanted to figure out how to best offer these services. And so they wanted to do a focus group with Black women who were actively on probation and parole. And they got wind that I was interning there and that I actually was a person with lived life experience. I had did 15 years in prison, went to prison 3 times, and now I was working on my bachelor's degree. And they was like, whoa, we have an intern here like that. That's great. would she be willing to lead the focus group? So that's how I was even engaged in this program in the very beginning. And I did the focus group with several women in the community, all Black women who were on probation and parole. And we asked them the questions. What do you need from treatment and recovery services? Mm-hmm. What have you gotten in the past that worked? What didn't work? What were some of the obstacles that kept you from getting the recovery and the reentry programming that you needed? And what would you like to see differently? And then we asked the question, if there were no barriers, if you could have anything you wanted, what mm-hmm. would you want? And most emphatically, and all across the board, they all said equivalently, they wanted to see Black leadership. They wanted to see people like them offering them services, and they wanted to be able to express their trauma and not be labeled as aggressive and loud and intimidating and unwilling to engage, because they felt like in the past that was their experience.
Oh boy, I think did that resonate with you?
Absolutely.
Okay, so I've never had that addiction experience or the prison experience, but definitely hearing that I'm aggressive, combative, that resonates completely.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like the most non-aggressive person that you can think of, completely nonviolent, but it seems somehow just as objects become weapons mm-hmm. in Black men's hands when Black women speak, it seems our language, the way we speak, is weaponized.
Mm-hmm.
And that translates into lots of issues on the job and lots of challenges around being able to hold certain leadership positions when the leaders are from another culture. And so that resonates with me, if not the other parts. So did that whole entire experience of the focus group, I mean, did that bring back emotion for you as well?
Yes, the focus group was very emotional, and I was actually proud and grateful to the county that they even thought to do that, that they even wanted to hear about the voice. And so with that voice of that population is what the program was built on. They took that to start. And was it emotional? Yes, it was emotional. And it was very emotional to take those voices back, go back into a room full with predominantly white people, all in leadership. I wasn't sure who did what job, what position they held.
Mm-hmm.
But I was led back into this room, in this meeting room, and I presented the outcome of what I learned at the focus group from my voice. And, of course, the trauma that it brought up for me, and that I 100% agree with the women, and I 100% can qualify and say that was my experience as well.
Okay, so you did the research for actually starting the Diane Wade House, or at least some of it, in terms of the focus group. So, wow, that's a lot of work. I also want to mention once again that you can call in and ask questions, make a statement, make a comment. The number is 503-231-8187. Again, that number is 503-231-8187. So, Anisha, you're done with the focus group, and then at some point you become an employee.
Right.
And tell me about how that happens and how exciting was that for you?
So, actually, it happened at the focus group. So, I'm sitting in the focus group. I'm done. I explain to them what I learned. I share my outcome. And then I say, hey, and if you're looking for somebody to hire for this position, I'm your guy. Like, I'm almost done with my bachelor's. I did 15 years in prison. I know this population. And I actually was sitting next to Shelley Mead, who I didn't know this at the time, but she was representing Bridges to Change as far as this committee working on this program. And they were thinking about putting this program under the umbrella of Bridges to Change. And she was a director there. And so she leaned in toward me and she said, okay, well, why don't you come and see me? And we made a date right then and there for me to come and talk to her about interviewing for this program.
Perfect, perfect. So that was the start. I'm not all that familiar with Bridges to Change. And for our listeners who are listening in, can you tell us a little bit about Bridges to Change? I know they're a nonprofit based in the Portland area. What else can you tell us?
So Bridges to Change is a reentry program. They have about 150 employees. All the positions may not be filled right now, but I know that they have about 150 employees. They run reentry houses for people coming out of prison. I know that it was started in 2004 by a couple, a white couple, and it's been predominantly white up until this point. They've never done culturally specific services before. to my knowledge and to the best of my understanding, they never had black leadership before, in senior black leadership ever. But they owned that. They said that they had problem retaining black employees. They had problems serving black clients, but they wanted to do something different. And Shelley Mead came across to me as somebody who was very genuine and authentic, and she did a lot of work. She mm-hmm. was a champion. She was a partner with the black community. She did several listening sessionings with us. She gained my trust. She gained my admiration, and she helped to get the program off the ground. And we had a good relationship.
That sounds great. Let me ask you this. So I see a lot of organizations that want to dive into serving specific populations. In fact, I was just teaching a program on how to transition to do that. Did you see Bridges to Change doing any of that transitional work? For example, making land acknowledgement statements, making sure that the brochures and the materials reflected the people that they were serving, reaching out to the community to try and hire individuals that were familiar with the community and specifically the black community to be able to have those programs be successful. Did you see any of that work going on at the management level, not with the Diane Wade House, but with the organization? Did you see that commitment from senior leadership to the black community?
No, I think that in senior leadership, Shelley Mead was the last champion that we had within that organization. I think the HR, Jordan Kibbe, wanted to, but for every reason, because of her position, she kind of held back. As far as the brochures and stuff, we didn't really like the initial thought process, and we weren't really included. They wanted to include me, but I believe in village style supervision, so I took it to my staff and said, it's not just about my voice, it's about my staff voice. There's seven women that are on my staff that need to have input. So I went to Caitlin Bissett and said, hey, you need to sit down with them, and they need to figure out what they want the brochure to look like. And as far as the organization, Shelley, I think when she hired me, she really worked super hard with me to help me and figure out what we wanted to do as far as making sure we included the whole black community. Okay. And so, but I think that the responsibility was put on me, and I could handle it. Like, that's what I did. The senior leadership, no. They said, Onisha, we need to the black community's buy-in. We need, this is what we're willing to do, and we need you to get your voice out there and to get the buy-in. And that's what I did, and I was happy to do it. I was able to get the buy-in of the active addict, the correctional officers, the parole officers, the black community, and other workers who were invested in this program, because everybody was excited that we had a program for black women.
Yeah, I remember reading the story in the newspaper, and I was really excited too. And I was like, oh, okay. So, you know, this community often touts itself as progressive. Unfortunately, I don't necessarily see it in its hiring practices and the way nonprofits deliver services in Portland. Oftentimes, the nonprofits are not culturally agile or culturally competent in the least. So I was happy to see that there was an organization that was actually going to take up this work, and I was proud. I think there was a picture of someone sitting on a sofa.
Mm-hmm. That was me.
That was you sitting on the sofa. Okay, under a very large picture of a black woman. So I was excited about seeing the work that was done. So you join the Diane Wade House. You're working under Shelley Mead. You're very excited about the work. And then something started to change. What happened?
Well, one of the things that the black community and my staff and myself wanted, and we wanted to see, and we were very clear about, was that we wanted this program to be a movement. Erica Pruitt said that at one of the public speakers. This isn't just a program, this is a movement. So one of the things we wanted to incorporate was we wanted contractors from the black community to teach about ethnic and culture, to teach about self-sustainability, growing your own food, sex trafficking advocates, and also health and wellness. We wanted a black aerobics teacher. And so we talked to four prominent community members who are already doing this work on several platforms, mm-hmm. that some of them were already working with Mudbone.
Oh, yes. I love Mudbone.
Yes.
Shantae Johnson.
Yes.
Hello, Shantae.
Yes, yes. And so some of these people have been doing this work, some for free, some in other organizations. And they came in and they met Shelley Mead. She approved of all of them. And then she called me into the office and she said, you know what, we missed to step in this. We need a culturally specific director. So she, we engaged in interviews. We set up interviews with everybody. And this is something that was a huge challenge for my staff. They said Afrocentric is from the top down. So we have us. We have the clients. We have us. Then we have Onisha. And then it stops at Onisha. From Onisha on up, there's white leadership. We need to change that. So Shelly says, you're absolutely right. She listened to us. She talked to her consultants. So we were all set to hire a culturally specific director. And Shelly Mead was on board with that. At the time we were doing the interviews, Shelly left. And it was a very mysterious thing about her leaving. We didn't really know anything. We were just told she's on protected leave. We can't call, text, or email her. And then like a month and a half went by, and then we got an email saying that she had resigned. So it was like all these things that she has set in motion. She wasn't even there to interview the people who were trying to get hired for the culturally specific director. And everything just kind of fell apart. And that was like in December. And then when we got our first client, she wasn't there for that. Like, we didn't know anything, and we still don't know anything.
Sure. So then, what happened with the director? Was there a director hired?
No. Monta Knutson, the executive director, said that none of the candidates were a good fit and that we would reassess hiring at another time. But we never followed up on it. It never happened.
Okay. So now we're in
May.
Yeah, we're in May now. So no director was hired. In December, you get your first client, and then what happened?
We never got the contractors. So I was asking about the contractors. The house is open. These people we're ready to sign the contracts. I've already told them. Shelly said they've been approved to get hired. We were working with Sarah Mullen to get the funding straightened out. There shouldn't have been a problem in the funding.
And Sarah Mullins with
Sarah Mullins with the county, and she worked as part on this contract to help all of the details and everything to get together. And then mind you, as a manager, as a new manager and as a mid manager, and as someone who's handling the media, training the staff, running the temporary house, and also preparing the permanent house to be open, I'm going to all of these meetings at the county level, at the Bridges to Change leadership level, and I am the only black person at all of these meetings. And we were told to, well, you guys can get black mentorship from the community. So we were using, like, we were reaching out to like Erica Pruitt and Ebony Sloan Clark and like Felisa Otis and Javelin Hardy and First Lady Cassandra Miniweather. Like, we were reaching out to like all the black women in the community on our own time, on our free time, on our lunch time, like to get some kind of black leadership involved, because there was none. There was none.
I see. So that was kind of after the fact. I want to take just a moment to mention that this is Voices from the Edge, and this is my guest, Onisha Cochran Dumas, and I'm Rochelle Dixon. Onisha is the former program manager with the Diane Wade House. I also want to mention that coming up at 9 o'clock, we have Press Watch with Teresa Mitchell, and she's going to take a look at the news that you're not supposed to know. At 10, that'll be the Heather McCoy Show, and Heather talks to Blair Stenvik about the recent Mercury article titled The Future of Trans Healthcare in Portland. At 11, Between the Covers with host Suzanne LeGrand. She'll interview Amy Stanton and Catherine Connors, authors of The Feminine Revolution. And at 11:30, Words and Pictures features Peter Bragge. He's the artist behind the anarchist characters Buddy Bradley and Martini Batten. And they'll talk about his life in alternative comics. That sounds really interesting. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use the mobile app and click on donate. Again, this is a live show. You are able to call in. You can call in at 503-231-8187. So I'm back with Onisha, and I have a question. If you are reaching out to all these community members, it says you said it was on your own time. Is there any compensation for the labor that these women are doing, these black women in the community are doing from Bridges to Change? Any acknowledgement?
No, if they worked for the county and or they were contractors, like Javelin Hardy was contracted to mentor me for a short time. Felisa Otis was as well, but I only got to meet with her once. Because you got to remember, these women have full-time jobs, but all of the other mentors that we had to buy in to mentor the other seven staff, it was done on their own time. And like, I was salary, and I'm sure, like, the county leaders were salary. And so if we had lunch, that wasn't out of the ordinary. But the fact that we had to exert all this energy just to find those connecting dots, it was laborious. And my voice never died asking for these contractors. My voice never died as far as asking for Black leadership. And one of the things that that really harmed me and caused more trauma that frustrated me was the fact that I stood beside white leaders in the county and I did press. And I have a lot of respect and love for these white leaders because they said the right words. Like Abby Stamp talked about repairing the damage of mm-hmm. the harm that has been done the community. Deborah Cherkafori, we've done interviews with Kay Boo before together where she said the harm has been done to these women. We need to change things right now. And then we still have no Black leadership. You know, and so what I was continually asked for, and I think they got frustrated with me continually asked for, is that the fact that we continue have to ask for it is racism. The fact that we continue to have to ask for is systematic oppression. The fact that we don't have it, and here it is 5 months later after you promised us we would have it, is systematic oppression. The fact that you have Black bodies in the house, you have a Black woman going out here telling the black community to trust you, the fact that my name has been mentioned in 12 different media incidents to promote this program, yet when I come to the table, whatever it is we're talking about, whether it's about programming, referral forms, or budget, I am talking to a group of all white people. And a lot of people didn't know that. They're calling it an Afrocentric program, but I'm a mid-manager, a new manager. I don't have a supervisor. I don't have a Black leadership within Bridges to Change. Mm-hmm. And I'm dealing with a group of white people who may not be hateful. I'm not saying that they're hateful, racist people. What I'm saying is that every time we talk about Black trauma or people having Black power over this Black program, they become so uncomfortable, which is what happened with me. They became so uncomfortable that they would rather remove me than continue to hear my voice.
I understand. Have you read the book by Robin DiAngelo, White Fragility?
I have the book at home on my bookshelf, but I haven't read it in its entirety.
You've got to read it. You've got to read it. It explains perfectly what you're experiencing when you bring up the subject of systemic racism. It becomes problematic. A lot of people are still under the mind that racism is about name calling mm-hmm. or individual acts. They don't understand it's about redlining, mm-hmm. Banks not giving loans. It's mm-hmm. about hiring practices. It's about the way meetings are run and organized and who's at the table mm-hmm. and who's not at the table and whose voice is respected and whose voice is not respected. So we're talking about a systemic problem. And you bring these issues up and the first thing you usually hear is, well, I'm not a racist.
Right.
And so you're either holding up systemic racism or you're working to tear it down. Mm-hmm. There is no in between. Mm-hmm. We're all participating in it. I do anti-racist work. I'm a woman of color and specifically a Black woman with indigenous roots. And so when I do this work, a lot of folks have trouble with understanding the white dominant culture that they live in. Mm-hmm. I once heard someone say racism is not the fish in the water, mm-hmm. it's the water. Mm-hmm. So you're completely surrounded by it. But I want to get back to something that is traumatizing for me.
Right.
Because it's about me for this just one moment.
Okay.
So I just heard you say that a lot of free labor from Black women in the community was not acknowledged,
no,
paid for,
mm-mm,
respected.
Mm-mm.
And once again, why are Black women expected to do free labor?
Yeah.
And then when they give you the gift of your time, of their time and their energy and their collective wisdom, mm-hmm. why is it not respected? So when I hear you say that you went out and you talked to couple ministers and,
oh,
and Jacqueline Hardy.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, whoa. So the Manyweathers now, I don't know which, but they've been a thing for a while. They're
absolutely.
A big family. And so I'm just like, wow, they just were dismissive mm-hmm. of these black voices. How did that feel to you? Because I'm feeling traumatized right now.
Well, they had, and that's what I'm saying, the white leadership at Bridges to Change, they had no idea what we were doing to make sure that we created a program of integrity. Because what they didn't know and what they didn't understand is that it wasn't about me. It wasn't just about my 7 staff members. This program was for everybody in our community. And mm-hmm. most black people are aligned in my thinking that we believe in village-style community. It's not about one person. Not everybody puts their pants on one pants at a time. It's a humility in it. So yes, I went to Dion Preston, who ran Miracles. I went to Noni Kazi. You know, I went to Felisa Otis. I went to Javelin Hardy. I went to Antoinette Edwards. I went to Nike Green. Mm-hmm. Like, I went to the black women who are leaders in the community and said, help us. Like, we are under this umbrella of this program, and they have no idea what's going on. Mm-hmm. Like, anytime we try to advocate for our clients, they try to minimize and use legalese language to hide behind to make you feel like you're crazy. Well, you have a personal relationship. I don't have a personal relationship with this client. I'm advocating for this client because I'm fiercely overprotective over black women. We have been raped. We have been beaten. We've been out here homeless. We've been begging for these services, and every time we come in here and we express our trauma and we open up our mouth and we take a stand and we have the nerve to want to advocate for each other, then you start backing into a corner and you get afraid and you get uncomfortable. The temporary supervisor that they tried to give me, Terry Myers, even she said she didn't know what she was doing. She had a meeting with Erica Pruitt mm-hmm. and Ebony Sloan Clark where she referred to us as ghetto. And she came back to my supervision, and she said, yeah, they put me in my place. I said, what do you mean? She said, well, I said we was being ghetto, and they said that that wasn't a term that they were comfortable with me saying because I wasn't a black person, and maybe I didn't use it right. And she said, Onisha, I don't know how to help you guys. She said, teach me how to help you. Even the consultant that they brought in, Phyllis, was show me what can I do to help you. Even Caitlin Bissett, Monta's wife, will repeat over and over, what did Shelly do to help you? So now, not only do I have to go out here and promote this program in media,
you have to
be
train?
Your trauma porn, be your trauma porn to get the grant for this program, supervise this staff, deal with the trauma that my clients are going through, facilitate a temporary house, and go create a new house for this ribbon cutting ceremony. I also have to tell you how to help me.
Yeah, so now you're training your supervisor.
Exactly.
And was there extra compensation involved
no.
in that? Oh, so more free labor. More free labor. Did anyone tell them slavery days are over? Is this plantation capitalism that we're talking about here? Plantation capitalism. Things changed after Shelley Mead left.
Yeah.
And how long was it before Shelley Mead left until the day that you knew something was really wrong?
Well, I knew something was really wrong when I had to email them and ask them for a supervisor. I emailed all of leadership and asked them for a supervisor. They assigned me to Terry Myers. I had a personal conversation with Terry Myers, and I told her.
When was that?
This happened around around January 22nd. We were in supervision, and I said, you know what? We were having a debate about a programming budget and mm-hmm. how it should be spent. And my staff wanted something, and I was advocating for my staff, and she was, like, basically saying yes or no, yes or no. And I said, you know, I really have a problem with you guys labeling and telling the community this is an Afrocentric program, but the decisions stop with me, and you override us. And really, this isn't an Afrocentric program. It's being ran by white leadership. And I feel like
with
the community...
With the black cover?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and I feel like community needs to know that. Well, she shared our conversation with Monta, and Monta sent an email out
and
to
who,
the county leaders.
Who would Monta be?
Monta Knudsen is the executive director.
Okay, for Bridges to
for
change.
Bridges to change.
Okay.
So he sent an email out to county leaders. I think it was Erica Pruitt, Ebony Sloan Clark, and Anthony Jordan, and I don't know who else was on the email, but it was a bunch of county leaders. And he went on this rant about me saying white leadership is running everything and it's something, something, something. And I responded to the email. And then I texted him and I said, what's up? Like, why would you send that email? I shared this with Terry in supervision. Like, we need to talk. And so we sat and we talked, and he told me that Javelin Hardy, he didn't feel comfortable with her mentoring me anymore because he felt that she expressed about her trauma with working in systematic oppression systems, specifically sometimes not being heard. And he felt like, you know, he wanted me to have a new mentor, and he asked me who would I wanna to mentor me. And so I said Antoinette Edwards and Felisa Otis, and we knew Antoinette Edwards was too busy, and so he said we'll reach out to Felisa Otis. He reached out to Felisa Otis, and Felisa Otis did sit down with me, and we met, and she was it's so impactful and so helpful. But once again, she's a busy woman with her own career, mm-hmm. so our meetings yes. were limited. And then after that, then things, by this time, you have my mentors trying to serve all these women and all of this stuff coming
Can
up.
Can I ask you another question?
Yes, ma'am.
So when you got your mentor, what month was this?
So me and Miss Felisa didn't start meeting, have our first meeting until like March.
Oh, wow. So by then, the house has been open 3 months.
Yeah.
You haven't had a supervisor in a couple months?
Well, there was Terry Myers came. I didn't have, there was a gap of supervision from like early December until around January 22nd. When
okay.
Terry Myers officially became my supervisor.
Okay. And then you don't have, oh, you know what? It looks like we have a caller on line one. Let's take that call. We have Ross calling in.
Okay.
Yes, well,
welcome, Ross.
Hey, good morning. I'm really, really, really liking your program. You're talking so honest and everything, but I tuned in just a little bit late. So while you've gone on in details, I wonder if you would kind of refresh any listeners like me who tuned in late about what is the program that you're over which that you're talking about. Just a little bit on that. So
sure. Sure.
I am reminded, however, that one does need coaching. I'm an old guy, and I'm married to a black woman who came from the South years ago. When she came to San Francisco, they gave her classes as to how to deal with, you know, being in this environment of all white people around you and town. Anyway, et cetera. I appreciate what you're talking about. So I'm going to take all your comment off the air and carry on.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Well, Ross,
bye.
I appreciate you calling in. Thank you. And I'm going to let Onisha tell you once again what the Diane Wade House is. For those who are just tuned in, the Diane Wade House is...
So the Diane Wade House is an Afrocentric program that's supposed to serve the black community with a 38-bed capacity for women coming out of prison and jails, and it's being funded by a $2 million grant, MacArthur grant, from an oversight is supposed to be done by Multnomah County.
Perfect. Thank you so much for that refresh. And I want to remind you that you're listening to Voices from the Edge. And our guest is Onisha Cochran Dumas, who's the former program manager with the Diane Wade House. And so we're here today to take your calls. It's a live show. The number is 503-231-8187. Again, that's 503-231-8187. Call in with your questions. What are you thinking? What are your thoughts? Do you think Portland could be more progressive in its hiring practices? Do you think culturally specific programs work? Have you ever seen one that's worked? Have you been a part of one? Call in with your thoughts, your questions, your comments. We'd appreciate it. So I am going to let Onisha talk a little bit more about what happened after Shelley Mead left. Now she's got a new mentor. It's a couple months in. This program has been up for about 3 months when this happens, and it sounds like once again Bridges to Change is relying on free labor to do perhaps what they should have done with this gentleman just mentioned, coaching, like training. Mm-hmm. Could they have put some additional resources to you and helping you understand things? And also, could they put some additional resources to their senior management to help them understand things? Perhaps maybe some training in equity, maybe some training about white dominant culture and systemic oppression. Was anybody offered any paid training to help bridge this gap of understanding that was going on? It sounds like it was a very perilous time, a very challenging time, but it sounds like Bridges to Change was really relying on the unpaid labor of Black women, which I, as a member of this community, find very traumatizing and very upsetting. And it looks like we're going to have another call on the line here. It looks like we have Teresa Rayford on the line. So let's go to Teresa, and then we'll let you answer that question. Teresa, are you there?
Yes, ma'am. Good morning.
Okay. Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing all right. And
good.
I just wanted to say, Onisha, you are very articulate. I believe everything that you're saying, and thank you for having the courage to speak. And we all need that, and you're dynamic with it. So thank you, first of all, for standing up. And second of all, I just wanted to respond to the last caller and how he said, you know, back in the day, he moved out here with his wife and that she had to take classes to move into the circles or to be able to navigate the system and to be able to be employable here. I'm so happy that you're speaking out because Portland has been settled on that. That's some plantation type, you know, business and process. And I'm glad that you're exposing it for what it is because those days are over. Just the whole thought that we would have to be assimilated in order to provide services to our own community, it's just outrageous. And I just thank you for being dynamic in the way that you're speaking out about it and the fact that you're doing something about it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, so back to the question, do they offer you any supports in terms of training? Not free labor, because it sounds like they've been relying on free labor from the Black community, so they've been extracting and extracting and mining and mining and taking the labor and the energy out of the community to profit Bridges to Change.
Correct.
And it doesn't sound like the senior leadership has any intelligence around what it means to be a community member in the Black community. And you've gone out and you've represented this organization. You vouched for them.
I did.
You vouched for them.
I did.
And now you've got to come back to the community and say, wait a minute, I've had to do this. It's very difficult to say, you know, I may have made a misstep here because I thought I was doing this for the community. And now...
in the county. I don't want to leave them out of it. Like, I stood there with Abby Stamp. I stood there with Deborah Cherikafori, and they made me feel like they had my back. They made me feel like they were going to support me. I went to leadership classes, of course. I've been to Bowley training. I took the leadership, and I've been to school. But how much do we have to bow down and, like Teresa just said, assimilate ourselves to them? When do they get to meet us halfway? And not only are we looking at, one of my other mentors was talking to him about how immoral and unethical it is to have to go into all these meetings with the county, whether it's about referral forms, whether it's about programming, whether it's about budget, whether it's about advocating to bring the contractors in to teach these women what they need to know to be sustainable. I am consistently the only Black woman at the table telling you, begging you for money, begging you for programming power decision making, begging you for these opportunities to help my people, convincing you that we need this money, trying to extract this money from you, this $2 million budget that was supposed to be given to us so freely and easily, and everything's tied up. Mind you, our house was open December 15th. This is in May 9th, and we still haven't got the contractors. To my knowledge, those women still haven't started their programming. Those women still don't have a culturally specific manager. They don't have a Black manager, and they don't have a Black director, which we interviewed in December. And it breaks my heart, and it hurts, and it was traumatizing me to go to them white tables over and over and over and try to talk to these white people in a tone of voice, think about my body language, make sure I'm not being, make sure I'm being effective, make sure I'm not scaring
you. You don't
want to
be aggressive, right?
I don't want to be aggressive. And I also was hoping that one of the champions, like Abby or Deborah Cherkafori, anybody who stood with me, you tokenized me. And I want to say this because I know we're running out of time. When I knew that they were preparing to fire me, I was on the front page of the Oregonian on the 10th, which is our ribbon cutting ceremony. I worked my butt off to get that house ready.
Uh-huh, yes.
So we got the house ready on the 10th. By the 11th, I was in the behind the scenes in the office with HR and with the executive director, and they were preparing to fire me on the
11th. One day after the ribbon cutting.
One day after ribbon cutting, we're having this performance improvement plan discussion.
So do you think that was intentional? And tell
me. I think it was intentional. I don't think that they hired me with the intent to fire me, because Shelly Mead is the one who hired me.
Sure,
when she left, I think she believed in me. She promoted me to manager. I believe that when Monta and his wife, Caitlin, got to know me and got to see how serious and passionate I was, and how I wasn't going to let some of these issues go and some of these promises that they made to us go, and that I was going to continue to hold them accountable, and I wasn't going to back away from some of these issues, then I became the problem. Then because it was okay for me to be tokenized and to promote the program and to be the trauma porn and to vouch for them. But when I started to get into the nitty gritty of the issues and the promises and the money and the programming and the power structure, when I was starting to chip away at that and say, we need black leadership, you're going to hear my voice, then I became the identified problem. I became the identified patient, and they had to get rid of me, which is what they did.
I think that's a whole nother topic for another show, because Portland is definitely into trauma porn, I would say that, for people of color, black people, LGBTQ, definitely show us your trauma. And we live in an environment that's supposed to be progressive and liberal, but it doesn't show up in these nonprofit organizations. I want to ask, so you were on the 6-week program, and how many weeks into that 6-week improvement program were you let go?
So I had the conversation with them on the 11th. I went on vacation from the 12th. To the
April?
25th, yep.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a planned vacation that they all were, everybody was on board with. They knew I needed self-care. I did a lot of hard work, and it was planned 260 days previously. So the vacation had nothing to do with the other issues. So we had a conversation on the 11th, April 11th, April 12th to April 25th. I was on vacation. There was no interaction with me at all. I came back on the 25th, another performance improvement plan meeting with HR and four other directors. I didn't understand those interrogative, intimidating tactics, because it should have just been with my supervisor. Hey, Onisha, remember on the 11th before you went to vacation, you were put on a performance improvement plan. These are the objectives we need you to work on. Just a reminder, you've been on vacation. Hope you had a good time. Okay, we'll meet again to see if you've done any of these objectives. That's not what I got confronted with.
How can you do the objectives if you're on vacation?
Right, right. So that's what I'm assuming that a conversation should have looked like for me. That would have been trauma informed, but that's not what I got. I come back on the 25th. There's a room full of people. They want to talk about this crap again. And I'm like, okay, I'm on it. I'm on performance improvement plan. I know what I need to do. I'm going to do it. Like, and then it turned into this 3-hour conversation. Well, how can we support you? And then it brought up again, hire the culturally specific director you said you were going to hire. What about our contractors? This is what we need. You want to know how you can support me? This is how. And then at this point, because of their language and because of the intimidating tactics of having so many directors and HR in the room, I knew in that point in my spirit they were going to fire me. On the 25th and the 26th, I handled three of the objectives. I went and talked to the managers at Multnomah County. I talked to the parole officer that I had conflict with, Michelle Smith. Me and her hugged. Me and Katie Roller, one of the managers, had no issues at all. We had a wonderful conversation. On the 29th, this is 2 days now. 2 days I've been back to work. I did not do anything. On the 29th at 9 a.m., Monta Knudsen and Jordan Kibbe, the HR, called me into the office, and they terminated me at 9 a.m.
So it sounds like you didn't really actually get the 6 weeks to support.
I didn't get no weeks.
Yeah. We have just a couple minutes, so I want to ask you this question, because this is still yet unresolved.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted people to know about your experience. I know that there are different ways that people can support. Tell me what you're going to do next and how can people support you.
Come to the commissioner's meeting this morning. I want to address Deborah Cherkafori specifically. I want to know, why did they fall off with the support they presented to the public that they would have for us, and where is it at now?
And that meeting is at
the Hawthorne Building at 9:30 a.m., 501 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard.
Perfect. Perfect. Thank you so much for joining us, Onisha. So we've been talking with Onisha Cochran, former program manager with the Diane Wade House. Thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate all the time that you spent and invested, and good luck with your testimony today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth.
This is Alyssa Pariah, your friendly neighborhood agitator, the host of The Struggle, every Friday from 7 to 8 p.m. Listen to KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM, and online at kboo.fm. The Struggle is where organizers and activists doing good in the community come to discuss their work to get you to support them, maybe even join them. Remember The Struggle, every Friday, 7 to 8 p.m., KBOO Community Radio.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 8:59. Coming up this morning, coming up next, it's Press Watch, Teresa Mitchell's weekly look at the news you're not supposed to know. At 10 on The Heather McCoy Show, Heather talks to Blair Stenvik about their recent Mercury article titled The Future of Trans Healthcare is in Portland. At 11 on Between the Covers, host Suzanne LeGrand interviews Amy Stanton and Catherine Connors, authors of The Feminine Revolution. And at 11:30, Words and Pictures features Peter Bragg, artist behind anarchic characters Buddy Bradley and Martini Baton, talks about his life in alternative comics. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from the Portland State University Hatfield School of Government, offering a master's degree in health administration for those who want to make healthcare equitable through quality leadership and effective policies. More information is available online at pdx.edu/Hatfield School.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know.